"Some," Henry replied, grimacing. "Well, let me fix that for you, okay?" The physician extracted a 50cc needle from his pocket, along with a vial of Dilaudid. 2 to 4 milligrams was a strong dose for a normal person. He decided to go to 40 just to be sure. Henry had suffered enough. He filled the syringe, flicked the plastic body with a fingernail to take care of the little air bubble, then inserted it into the IV line, and pushed the plunger down quickly. "Ah," Henry had time to say, as the dazzling rush hit him. And, just that fast, his face went still, eyes wide open, pupils dilated in the last pleasure he would ever know. 10 seconds later, Kilgore touched the right carotid artery. There was nothing happening there, and Henry's breathing had stopped at once. Just to be completely sure, Kilgore took his stethoscope from his pocket and touched it to Henry's chest. Sure enough, the heart had stopped. "Nice fight, partner," the doctor told the body. Then he unhooked the IV line, switched off the electronic drug monitor system, and tossed the sheet over the face. So that was the end of the winos. Most of them had checked out early, except for Henry. The bastard was a fighter to the end, defying all predictions. Kilgore wondered if they might have tried one of the vaccines on him. B would almost certainly have saved him, but then they'd just have a healthy wino on their hands, and the project wasn't aimed at saving that sort of person. What use was he to anyone, really? Except maybe a liquor store owner. Kilgore left the room, waving to an orderly as he did so. In 15 minutes, Henry would be ashes floating in the air, his chemicals useful to some grass and trees as fertilizer when they fell back to earth, which was about as much a contribution as a person like that could hope to make. Then it was time to see Mary, F4, in her room. "How are you doing?" he asked.
"Fine," she replied sleepily.
Whatever discomfort she ought to be feeling was well submerged in the morphine drip. "You took a little walk last night?" Kilgore asked, checking her pulse. It was 92, strong and regular still. Well, she wasn't really into serious symptoms yet, though she'd never last as long as Henry had.
"Wanted to tell Daddy that I was okay," she explained.
"Think he's worried?"
"I haven't talked to him since I got here, and I thought..."
She dozed off. "Yeah, sure, you thought," Dr. Kilgore said to the unconscious form. "And we'll make sure that doesn't happen again." He changed the programming on the IV monitor, increasing the morphine drip by 50%. That should keep her in the bed. 10 minutes later, he was outside, walking north to where... there it was. And he saw Ben Farmer's pickup truck parked in the usual place. The inside of the building smelled of birds, as well it might, though it looked more like a horse barn. Every door was barred too closely for an arm to reach in, or for a bird to get out. He walked down the row of doors until he found Farmer in with one of his favorites. "Working overtime?" Kilgore asked. "A little," the security man agreed. "Come on, Festus," he said next. The barn owl flapped its wings angrily, then lifted off for the 6-foot trip to Farmer's gloved hand. "I think you're all fixed, my friend." "Doesn't look very friendly," the physician observed. "Owls are hard to work with sometimes, and Festus has a mean side," the former Marine told him, walking the owl back to its perch and leaving him there. Then he slipped out of the door. "Not the smartest raptors, owls. Hard as hell to train. Not even going to try with him." "Just release him?" "Yeah. End of the week, I think." Farmer nodded. "It's been 2 months, but his wings all healed now. I expect he's ready to go back out and find himself a barn full of mice to eat.
Was that the one hit by the car?
No, that's Niccolo, the great horned owl. No, Festus, I think he probably flew into a power line. Wasn't looking the right way, I guess. Both his eyes seemed to work just fine. But birds screw up, too, just like people. Anyway, I fixed his broke wing. Did a good job of it, if I do say so myself.
Farmer allowed himself a satisfied smile.
But old Festus ain't very grateful about it.
Ben, you ought to be a doctor. You're so good at this. Were you a medic in the Marines?
Just a grunt. Marines get their medics from the Navy, Doc.
Farmer took off his thick leather gauntlet and flexed his fingers before putting it back on.
You hear about Mary?
What happened?
Truth. I was off taking a leak. Sat back down reading my magazine, and when I looked up, she wasn't there. I figure she was loose for, 10 minutes before I put the call out.
I screwed up, Doc, and that's a fact, he admitted.
No real harm done, I think.
Yeah, well, how about me moving that computer to a room with a lock on the door, eh?
He walked to the end of the room, opened another door.
Hey, Baron, the man said next.
A moment later, the Harris Hawk jumped onto the offered leather arm.
Yeah, that's my buddy. You're ready to go back outside, too, ain't you?
Find yourself some juicy rabbits, maybe?
There was a real nobility to these birds, Kilgore thought. Their eyes were sharp and clear, their motions powerful and redolent of purpose. And while that purpose might seem cruel to their prey, that was nature at work, wasn't it? These raptors kept the balance in place, winnowing out the slow, the crippled, and the stupid. But more than that, the birds of prey were just plain noble in the way they soared upward and looked down on the world that lay beneath them, and decided who would live and who would die. Much as he and his fellow team members were doing, Kilgore thought, though human eyes lacked the hardness he saw here. He had to smile at Baron, who was soon to be released into the wild, soon to soar on the thermals above Kansas.
"Will I be able to do this when we're out in the project?" Farmer asked, setting Baron back on his wooden perch.
"What do you mean, Ben?"
"Well, Doc, some people say that I won't be able to keep birds once we're out there, 'cause it interferes like. Hell, I take good care of my birds. You know, captive raptors live 2-3 times as long as the ones in the wild. And yeah, I know that upsets things a little bit, but damn it.
Ben, it's not big enough to worry about. I understand you and the hawks okay. I like 'em too.
Nature's own smart bomb, Doc. I love to watch 'em work. And when they get hurt, I know how to fix 'em."
"You're very good at that. All your birds look healthy."
"Ought to be. I feed 'em good. I live-trap mice for 'em. They like their meals warm, you know."
He walked back to his work table, took his gauntlet off, and hung it on the hook.
"Anyway, that's my work for the morning."
"Okay, get on home, Ben. I'll see that the computer room is secured. Let's not have any more subjects taking any walks."
"Yes, sir."
"How's Henry doing?" Farmer asked, fishing in his pocket for his car keys.
Henry checked out.
"I didn't figure he had much time left. So, no more of the winos, eh?"
He saw the shake of Kilgore's head.
"Well, too bad for him.
Tough bastard, wasn't he?"
"Sure was, Ben, but that's the way it goes."
"Sure enough, Doc. Shame we can't just lay the body out for the buzzards. They have to eat, too. But it is kind of gross to watch how they do it."
He opened the door.
"See you tonight, Doc."
Kilgore followed him out, killing the lights. No, they couldn't deny Ben Farmer the right to keep his birds. Falconry was the real sport of kings, and from it You could learn so much about birds, how they hunted, how they lived. They'd fit into nature's great plan. The problem was that the project had some really radical people in it, like the ones who objected to having physicians, because they interfered with nature. Curing people of disease was interference, allowed them to multiply too fast and upset the balance again. Yeah, sure. Maybe in 100 years, more like 200, they might have Kansas fully repopulated. But not all of them would remain in Kansas, would they? No, they'd spread out to study the mountains, the wetlands, the rainforests, the African savanna. And then they'd return to Kansas to report what they'd learned, to show their videotapes of nature in action. Kilgore looked forward to that. Like most project members, he devoured the Discovery Channel on his cable system. There was so much to learn, so much to understand, because he, like many, wanted to get the whole thing, to understand nature in her entirety. That was a tall order, of course, maybe an unrealistic one. But if he didn't make it, then his children would. Or their children, who'd be raised and educated to appreciate nature in all her glory. They'd travel about, field scientists all. He wondered what the ones who went to the dead cities would think. It'd probably be a good idea to make them go, so that they'd understand how many mistakes man had made, and learn not to repeat them. Maybe he'd lead some of those field trips himself. New York would be the big one, the really impressive don't-do-this lesson. It would take 1,000 years, maybe more, before the buildings collapsed from rusting structural steel and lack of maintenance. The stone parts would never go away, but relatively soon, maybe 10 years or so, deer would return to Central Park. The vultures would do just fine for some time. Lots of bodies to eat, or maybe not. At first the corpses would be buried in the normal civilized way, but in a few weeks those systems would be overwhelmed, and then people would die, probably in their own beds. And then, rats, of course. The coming year would be a banner one for rats. The only thing was, rats depended on people to thrive. They lived on garbage and the output of civilization, a fairly specialized parasite. And, this coming year, they'd have a gut-filling worldwide feast. And then, what? What would happen to the rat population? Dogs and cats would live off them, probably, gradually reaching a balance of some sort. But without millions of people to produce garbage for the rats to eat, their numbers would decline over the next 5 or 10 years. That would be an interesting study for one of the field teams. How quickly would the rat population trend down? And how far down might it go? Too many of the people in the project concerned themselves with the great animals. Everyone loved wolves and cougars, noble, beautiful animals so harshly slaughtered by men because of their depredation of domestic animals. And they'd do just fine once the trapping and poisoning stopped. But what of the lesser predators? What about the rats? Nobody seemed to care about them, but they were part of the system, too. You couldn't apply aesthetics to the study of nature, could you? If you did, then how could you justify killing Mary Bannister, subject F4? She was an attractive, bright, pleasant woman, after all. Not very like Chester or Pete or Henry, not offensive to behold as they had been. But like them, a person who didn't understand nature, didn't appreciate her beauty, didn't see her place in the great system of life, and was therefore unworthy to participate. Too bad for her. Too bad for all the test subjects. But the planet was dying and had to be saved, and there was only one way to do it, because too many others had no more understanding of the system than the lower animals who were an unknowing part of the system itself. Only man could hope to understand the great balance. Only man had the responsibility to sustain that balance. And if that meant the reduction of his own species, well,
everything had its price. The greatest and finest irony of all was that it required a huge sacrifice, and that the sacrifice came from man's own scientific advances. Without the instrumentalities that threatened to kill the planet, the ability to save it would not have existed. Well, of such irony was reality made, the epidemiologist told himself. The project would save nature herself, and the project was made of relatively few people, less than 1,000, plus those who had been selected to survive and continue the effort, the unknowing ones whose lives would not be forfeit to the crimes committed in their names. Most would never understand the cause for their survival, that they were the wife or child or close relative of a project member, or had skills that the project needed. Airplane pilots, mechanics, farmers, communications specialists, and the like. Someday they might figure it out. That was inevitable, of course. Some people talked, and others listened. When the listeners figured it out, they would probably be horrified. But then it would be far too late for them to do anything about it. There was a wonderful inevitability to it all. Oh, there would be some things he'd miss. The theater, the good restaurants in New York, for example. But surely there would be some good cooks in the project. Certainly there would be wonderful raw materials for them to work with. The project's installation in Kansas would grow all the grain they needed. And there would be cattle as well, until the buffalo spread out. The project would support itself by hunting for much of its meat. Needless to say, some members objected to that. They objected to killing anything. But cooler and wiser heads had prevailed on that issue. Man was both a predator and a toolmaker, and so guns were okay too. A far more merciful way to kill game, and man had to eat too. And so, in a few years, men would saddle up their horses and ride out to shoot a few buffalo, butcher them, and bring back the healthy, low-fat meat, and deer, and pronghorn antelope, and elk. Cereals and vegetables would be grown by the farmers. They'd all eat well and live in harmony with nature. Guns weren't all that great an advancement on bows and arrows, were they? And they'd be able to study the natural world in relative peace. It was a beautiful future to look forward to, though the initial 4 to 8 months would be pretty dreadful. The stuff that'd be on TV and the radio and the newspapers, while they lasted, would be horrible. But again, everything had a price. Humanity, as the dominant force on the planet, had to die, to be replaced by nature herself, with just enough of the right people to observe and appreciate what she was and what she did. "Dr. Chavez, please," Popoff told the operator at the hospital. "Wait, please," the female voice replied. It took 70 seconds. "Dr. Chavez," another female voice said. "Oh, sorry, I have the wrong number," Popoff said, and cradled the phone. Excellent. Both Clark's wife and daughter worked at the hospital, just as he'd been told. That confirmed that this Domingo Chavez was over in Hereford as well. So he knew both the chief of this Rainbow Group and one of its senior staff members. Chavez probably was one of those. Maybe the chief of intelligence for the group? No, Popoff thought, he was too junior for that. That would be a Brit, a senior man from MI6, someone known to the Continental Services. Chavez was evidently a paramilitary officer, just as his mentor was. That meant that Chavez was probably a soldier type. Maybe a field leader? A supposition on his part, but a likely one. A young officer, physically fit by reports. Too junior for much of anything else. Yes, that made sense. Popoff had stolen a base map from Miles, and had marked the location of Clark's home on it. From that he could easily deduce the route his wife took to the local hospital,
and figuring out her hours would not be terribly difficult. It had been a good week for the intelligence officer, and now it was time to leave. He packed his clothes and walked to his rented car, then drove to the lobby to check out. At London Heathrow, a ticket was waiting for the 747 flight back to New York's JFK International. He had some time, so he rested in the British Airways first-class lounge, always a comfortable place, with the wine, even champagne, bottles set out in the open. He indulged himself, then sat on one of the comfortable couches and picked up a complimentary newspaper. But instead of reading, he started going over the things he'd learned, and wondering what use his employer would wish to make of it. There was no telling at the moment, but Popov's instincts made him think about telephone numbers he had in Ireland. "Yes, this is Henriksen," he said into the hotel phone.
"This is Bob Auckland," the voice said.
He was the senior cop at the meeting, Bill remembered.
"I have good news for you."
"Oh, what might that be, sir?"
"The name's Bob, old man. We spoke with the minister, and he agrees that we should award Global Security the consulting contract for the Olympics."
"Thank you, sir."
"So, could you come down in the morning to work out the details with me?"
"Okay, good."
"When can I go out to the facility?" "I'll fly you down myself tomorrow afternoon."
"Excellent, Bob. Thank you for listening to me. What about your SAS people?"
"They'll be at the stadium as well."
"Great. I look forward to working with them," Henriksen told him.
"They want to see that new communications equipment you told them about.
E-Systems has just started manufacturing it for our Delta people. 6 ounces per unit, real-time 128-bit encryption, X-band frequency, sideband, burst transmission. Damn near impossible to intercept and highly reliable."
"For what do we deserve this honor, Ed?" Clark asked.
"You have a fairy godmother at the White House. The first 30 sets go to you. Ought to be there in 2 days," the DCI told Rainbow Six.
"Who at the White House?"
"Carol Breitling, presidential science advisor. She's into the crippy gear, and after the World Park job, she called me to suggest you get these new radios."
"She's not cleared into us, Ed," Clark remembered. "At least I don't remember her name on the list."
"Well, somebody must have told her something, John. When she called, she knew the code word. And she is cleared into damned near everything, remember? Nuclear weapons, and all the commo stuff."
"The president doesn't like her, or so I hear."
"Yeah, she's a radical tree-hugger, I know. But she's pretty smart, too. And getting you this gear was a good call on her part. I talked to Sam Wilson down at Snake headquarters, and his people have signed off on it with enthusiasm. Jam-proof, encrypted, digital clarity, and light as a feather."
"As well it ought to be, at $7,000 per set. But that included the R&D costs," Foley reminded himself. He wondered if it might be something his field officers could use for covert operations.
"Okay, 2 days, you said?"
"Yep, regular trash haul out of Dover to RAF Mildenhall. And a truck from there, I guess. Oh, one other thing."
"What's that?"
"Tell Noonan that his letter about that People Finder gadget has generated results. The company's sending a new unit for him to play with. 4 of them, as a matter of fact. Improved antenna and GPS locator, too."
"What is that thing, anyway?"
"I've only seen it once. It seems to track people from their heartbeats."
"Oh, how's it do that?" Foley asked.
"Damned if I know, Ed. But I've seen it track people through blank walls. Noonan's going nuts over it. He said it needed improvements, though."
"Well, DKL, that's the company, must have listened. 4 new sets are in the same shipment with a request for your evaluation of the upgrade."
"Okay, I'll pass that along to Tim."
"Any further word on the terrorists you got in Spain?"
"We're faxing it over later today. They've ID'd 6 of them now. Mainly suspected Basques," the Spanish figured out. "The French have largely struck out just 2 probables. Well, 1 of them's fairly certain. And still no clue on who might be sending these people out of the dugout after us.
Russian, Foley said. A KGB riff, I bet.
I won't disagree with that, seeing how that guy showed up in London, we think. But the five guys haven't turned up anything else.
Who's working the case at five?
Holt. Cyril Holt, Clark answered.
Oh, okay, I know Cyril. Good man. You can believe what he tells you.
Well, that's nice, but right now I believe it when he says he doesn't have jack shit.
I've been toying with the idea of calling Sergei Nikolaevich myself and asking for a little help.
I don't think so, John. That'll have to go through me, remember? I like Sergei too, but not on this one. Too open-ended.
That leaves us dead in the water, Ed.
I do not like the fact that there's some Rusky around who knows my name and my current job.
Foley had to nod at that. No field officer liked the idea of being known to anyone at all, and Clark had ample reason to worry about it, with his family sharing his current duty station. He'd never taken Sandy into the field to use them as cover on a job, as some field officers had done in their careers. No officer had ever lost a spouse that way, but a few had been roughed up, and it was now contrary to CIA policy. More than that, John had lived his entire professional life as an unperson, a ghost seen by few, recognized by none, and known only to those on his own side. He would no more wish to change that than to change his sex, but his anonymity had been changed, and it upset him. Well, the Russians knew him and knew about him, and that had been his own doing in Japan and Iran. He must have known then that his actions would have consequences.
John, they know you. Hell, Golovko knows you personally. And it figures they'd be interested in you, right?
I know, Ed, but... damn it!
John, I understand. But you're high profile now, and there's no evading that fact.
So just sit tight, do your job, and let us rattle some bushes to find out what's happening, okay?
I guess, Ed... was the resigned reply. If I turn up anything, I'll be on the phone to you immediately.
Aye, aye, sir, Clark replied, using the naval term that had been part of his life a long time ago. Now he reserved it for things he really didn't like. The assistant special agent in charge of the Gary, Indiana FBI field office was a serious black man named Chuck Ussery. 44, a recent arrival in this office, he'd been in the Bureau for 17 years, and before that a police officer in Chicago. Skip Bannister's call had rapidly been routed to his desk, and inside 5 minutes he'd told the man to drive to the office at once. 25 minutes later the man came in. 5'11", stocky, 55 or so, and profoundly frightened, the agent saw. First of all, he got the man sat down and offered him coffee, which was refused. Then came the questions, routine at first. Then the questions got a lot more directed.
Mr. Bannister, do you have the email you told me about?
James Bannister pulled the sheet of paper from his pocket and handed it across. Three paragraphs, Ussery saw, disjointed and ungrammatical. Confused. His first impression was,
Mr. Bannister, do you have any reason to suspect that your daughter has ever used drugs of any kind?
Not my Mary, was the immediate reply. No way.
Okay, she likes to drink beer and wine, but no drugs. Not my little girl, not ever.
Ussery held up his hands. Please, I understand how you feel. I've worked kidnappings before, and—
You think she's been kidnapped?
Skip Bannister asked, now faced with the confirmation of his greatest fear. That was far worse than the suggestion that his daughter was a doper.
Based on this letter, yes, I think it's a possibility. And we will treat this case as a kidnapping investigation.
Ussery lifted his phone.
Send Pat O'Connor in, will you? He told his secretary.
Supervisory Special Agent Patrick D. O'Connor was one of the Gary office's squad supervisors. 38, red-haired, fair-skinned, and very fit, O'Connor headed the office kidnapping squad.
"Yeah, Chuck," he said, coming in.
"This is Mr. James Bannister. He has a missing daughter, age 21, disappeared in New York about a month ago. Yesterday he got this on his email."
Ossery handed it over.
O'Connor scanned it and nodded.
"Okay, Chuck?"
"Pat, it's your case. Run with it."
"You bet, Chuck."
"Mr. Bannister, would you come with me, please?"
"Pat runs these cases for us," Ossery explained. "He will take charge of it and report to me on a daily basis.
Mr. Bannister, the FBI treats kidnappings as major felonies. This will be a top-priority case until we clear it.
10 men, Pat?"
"For starters, yes. More in New York."
"Sir," he said to their guest, "we all have kids. We know how you feel. If there's a way to locate your daughter for you, we'll find it. Now I need to ask you a bunch of questions so that we can get started, okay?"
"Yeah."
The man stood and followed O'Connor out into the office bay. He'd be there for the next 3 hours, telling everything he knew about his daughter and her life in New York to this and other agents. First of all, he handed over a recent photograph, a good one as it turned out. O'Connor looked at it. He'd keep it for the case file. O'Connor and his squad hadn't worked a kidnapping in several years. It was a crime the FBI had essentially extinguished in the United States. Kidnapping for money, in any case. There was just no percentage in it. The FBI always solved them, came down on the perps like the wrath of God. Today's kidnappings were generally of children, and, parental kidnappings aside, were almost always by sexual deviants who most often used them for personal gratification, and, often as not, killed them thereafter. If anything, that merely increased the FBI's institutional rage. The Bannister case, as it was already being called, would have the highest priority in manpower and resources in every office it might touch. Pending cases against organized crime families would be set aside for this one. That was just part of the FBI's institutional ethos. 4 hours after Skip Bannister's arrival in the Gary office, two agents from the New York Field Division in the Jacob Javits Building downtown knocked on the door of the superintendent of Mary Bannister's dingy apartment building. The super gave them the key and told them where the apartment was. The two agents entered and commenced their search, looking first of all for notes, photographs, correspondence, anything that might help. They'd been there an hour when an NYPD detective showed up, summoned by the FBI office to assist. There were 30,000 policemen in the city, and for a kidnapping, they could all be called upon to assist in the investigation and canvassing.
"Got a picture?" the detective asked.
"Here." The lead agent handed over the one faxed from Gary.
"You know, I got a call a few weeks ago from somebody in Des Moines. Girl's name was Pretlow, I think."
"Yeah. Ann Pretlow, mid-20s, legal secretary. Lived a few blocks from here. Just up and disappeared. Didn't show up for work, just vanished. Roughly the same age and sex, guys," the detective pointed out.
"Connection, maybe?"
"Been checking Jane Doe's?" the junior agent asked. He didn't have to go further. Their instant thought was the obvious one. Was there a serial killer operating in New York City? That sort of criminal nearly always went after women between 18 and 30 years of age, as selective a predator as there was anywhere in nature.
"Yeah, but nothing that fit the Pretlow girl's description, or this one for that matter."
He handed the photo back.
"This case is a head-scratcher.
Find anything?"
"Not yet," the senior agent replied. "Diary, but nothing useful in it. No photos of men, just
clothes, cosmetics, normal stuff for a girl this age.
Prince?
A nod. That's next. We have our guy on the way now. But they all knew that this was a thin reed after the apartment had been vacant for a month. The oils that made fingerprints evaporated over time, though there was some hope here, in a climate-controlled and sealed apartment.
This one's not going to be easy, the NYPD detective observed next.
They never are, the senior FBI agent replied.
What if there's more than two? The other FBI agent asked.
Lots of people turn up missing in this town, the detective said, but I'll run a computer check. Subject F5 was a hot little number, Kilgore saw. And she liked Chip, too. That wasn't very good news for Chip Smitten, who hadn't been exposed to Shiva by injection, vaccine testing, or the fogging system. No, he'd been exposed by sexual contact only. And now his blood was showing antibodies, too. So that means of transmission worked also. And, better yet, it worked female to male, not just male to female. Shiva was everything they'd hoped it would be. It was distasteful to watch people making love. Not the least bit arousing for him, playing voyeur. Anne Pretlow, F5, was within 2 days of symptoms, judging by her blood work, eating, drinking, and being very merry right before his eyes on the black-and-white monitor. Well, the tranquilizers had lowered every subject's resistance to loose behavior, and there was no telling what she was like in real life, though she certainly knew the techniques well enough. Strangely, Kilgore had never paid attention to this sort of thing in animal tests. Rats, he imagined, came into season, and when they did, the boy rats and girl rats must have gotten it on. But somehow he'd never noticed. He respected rats as a life form, but didn't find their sexual congress the least bit interesting. Whereas here, he had to admit to himself, he did find his eyes returning to the screen every few seconds. Well, Pretlow, subject F5, was the cutest of the bunch. And if he'd found her in a singles bar, he might have offered her a drink and said hello and let things develop. But she was doomed, too, as doomed as white, bred-for-the-purpose lab rats. Those cute little pink-eyed creatures were used all over the world because they were genetically identical, and so test results in one country would match the test results generated anywhere else in the world. They probably didn't have the wherewithal to survive in the wild, and that was too bad. But their white color would work against them. Cats and dogs would spot them far more easily. And that was not a good thing in the wild, was it? And they were an artificial species anyway, not part of nature's plan, but a work of man, and therefore unworthy of continuance. A pity they were cute, but that was a subjective, not objective, observation, and Kilgore had long since learned to differentiate between the two. After all, Pretlow, F5, was cute too, and his pity for her was a lingering, atavistic attitude on his part, unworthy of a project member. But that got him thinking as he watched Chip Smitten, Screw, and Pretlow. This was the kind of thing Hitler might have done with Jews, saved a small number of them as human lab rats, maybe as crash test dummies for auto-safety tests. So did that make him a Nazi? Kilgore thought. They were using F5 and M7 as such. But no, they didn't discriminate on race or creed or gender, did they? There were no politics involved, really. Well, maybe, depending on how one defined the term. Not in the way he defined the term. This was science, after all. The whole project was about science and love of nature. Project members included all races and categories of people, though not much in the way of religions, unless you considered love of nature to be a religion. Which in a way it was, the doctor told himself.
Yes, surely it was.
What they were doing on his TV screen was natural, or nearly so, as it had been largely instigated by mood depressants,
but the mechanics certainly were. So were their instincts, he to spread his seed as far as possible, and she to receive his seed. And his own, Kilgore's mind went on, to be a predator, and through his depredations, to decide which members of that species would live and which would not. These two would not live, attractive as both were. Like the lab rats with their cute white hair and cute pink eyes and twitching white whiskers. Well, none of them would be around much longer, would they? It was aesthetically troubling, but a valid choice in view of the future that they all beheld. Chapter 22 Countermeasures.
So, nothing else from our Russian friend? Bill Tawney asked.
Nothing, Cyril Holt confirmed.
Tapes of Kirilenko show that he walks to work the same way every day and at exactly the same time, when the streets are crowded, stops in his pub for a pint 4 nights out of 5, and bumps into all manner of people. But all it takes is a minor attempt at disguise and a little knowledge of tradecraft to outfox us, unless we really tighten our coverage, and there's too great a chance that Ivan Petrovich would notice it and simply upgrade his own efforts to remain covert. It's a chance we'd prefer not to take.
Quite so, Tawney had to agree, despite his disappointment. Nothing from other sources? Other sources meant whomever the security service might have working for them inside the Russian embassy. There almost had to be someone there, but Holt would not discuss it over a telephone line, encrypted or not. Because if there was one thing you had to protect in this business, it was the identity of your sources. Not protecting them could get them killed.
No, Bill, nothing. Vanya hasn't spoken over his phone line to Moscow on this subject, nor has he used his secure fax line. Whatever discussions developed from this incident, well, we do not have even a confirmed face. Just that chap in the pub. And that might well have been nothing. 3 months ago, I had one of my chaps strike up a conversation with him at the pub, and they talked about football. He's a serious fan, and he knows the game quite well, and never even revealed his nationality. His accent is bloody perfect. So that chap in the photo might well be nothing at all, just another coincidence. Kirilenko is a professional, Bill. He doesn't make many mistakes. Whatever information came out of this was doubtless written up and couriered off. So we probably have a KGB riff prowling around London still, probably with whatever information Moscow has on our Mr. Clark, and doing what we do not know.
Correct, Bill, Holt agreed. I can't say that I like it either, but there you are.
What have you turned up on KGB PIRA contacts?
We have a few things. One photo of someone else from a meeting in Dublin 8 years ago, and oral reports of other contacts with physical description. Some might be the chap in the photo, but the written descriptions fit about a third of male humanity, and we're leery of showing the photos around quite yet.
Tawney didn't need to be told why. It was well within the realm of possibility that some of Holt's informants were indeed double agents, and showing them the photos of the man in the pub might well do nothing more than alert the target of the investigation to the fact that someone knew who he was. That would cause him to become more cautious, perhaps change his appearance, and the net result would be to make things worse instead of better. This was the most complex of games, Tawney reminded himself. And what if the whole thing was nothing more than curiosity on the part of the Russians, merely keeping track of a known intelligence officer on the other side? Hell, everyone did that. It was just a normal part of doing business. The bottom line was that they knew what they didn't know. No, Tawney thought. They didn't even know that much. They knew that they didn't know something, but they didn't even know what it was that they wanted to find out. What was the significance of this blip of information that had appeared on the scope?
What's this for? Henriksen asked innocently.
A fog-cooling system. We got it from your chaps, Auckland said.
Huh?
I don't understand, the American replied.
One of our engineers saw it. Arizona, I think. It sprays a very fine water mist.
The tiny droplets absorb heat energy and evaporate into the atmosphere, has the same effect as air conditioning, but with a negligible energy expenditure.
Ah, Bill Henriksen said, doing his best to act surprised. How widely distributed is the system?
Just the tunnels and concourses. The architect wanted to put it all over the stadium, but people objected. Said it would interfere with cameras and such, Auckland answered. Too much like a real fog.
Okay, I think I need to look at that.
Why?
Well, sir, it's a hell of a good way to deliver a chemical agent, isn't it?
The question took the police official seriously aback.
Well, yes, I suppose it would be.
Good. I have a guy in the company, former officer in the U.S. Army Chemical Corps, expert on this sort of thing. Degree from MIT. I'll have him check it out ASAP.
Yes, that is a good idea, Bill. Thank you, Auckland said, kicking himself for not thinking of that on his own. Well, he was hiring expertise, wasn't he? And this Yank certainly seemed to be an expert.
Does it get that hot here?
Oh, yes, quite. We expect temperatures in the 90s. Fahrenheit, that is. We're supposed to think in Celsius nowadays, but I never did learn that.
Yeah, me neither, Henriksen noted.
Anyway, the architect said that this was an inexpensive way to cool the spectators down, and quite reasonable to install. It feeds off the fire sprinkler system. Doesn't even use much water for what it does. It's been installed for over a year. We test it periodically. American company. Can't recall the name at the moment.
Cool spray of Phoenix, Arizona, Henriksen thought. He had the plans for the system in the file cabinet in his office. It would play a crucial role in the project's plans, and had been seen as a godsend from the first moment. Here was the place. Soon would come the time.
Heard anything more from the Brits?
We have an inquiry in, but no reply yet, Auckland answered. It is a very hush-hush project, evidently.
Henriksen nodded. Politics always gets in the way. And with luck, it would stay that way.
Quite, Auckland agreed with a nod.
Detective Lieutenant Mario D'Alessandro punched up his computer and accessed the NYPD Central Records file. Sure enough, Mary Bannister was in there, as was Ann Pretlow. Then he set up a search routine, picking gender women, age 18 to 30 for starters, and picking the run icon with his mouse. The system generated 46 names, all of which he saved to a file he created for the purpose. The system didn't have photos built in. He'd have to access the paper files for those. He deselected 10 names from Queens and Richmond boroughs for the moment, saving for the moment only Manhattan missing girls. That came down to 21. Next, he deselected African-American women, because if they were dealing with a serial killer, such criminals usually selected clones as victims. The most famous of them, Theodore Bundy, had almost exclusively picked women who parted their hair down the middle, for instance. Bannister and Pretlow were white, single, reasonably attractive, ages 21 and 24, and dark-haired. So, 18 to 30 should be a good straddle, he thought. And he further deselected the names that didn't fit that model. Next, he opened the department's Jane Doe file to look up the recovered bodies of murder victims who had not yet been identified. He already knew all of these cases from his regular work. Two fit the search parameters, but neither was Bannister or Pretlow. So this was, for the moment, a dry hole. That was both good and bad news. The two missing women were not definitely dead, and that was the good news. But their bodies could have been cleverly disposed of. The Jersey marshes were nearby, and that area had been a prime dumping site for bodies since the turn of the century. Next, he printed up his list of missing women. He'd want to examine all the paper files, including the photos, with the two FBI agents. Both Pretlow and Bannister had brown hair of roughly the same length,
and maybe that was enough of a commonality for a serial killer. But no, Bannister was still alive, or so the email letter suggested. Unless the serial killer was the kind of sick person who wanted to taunt the families of his victims. D'Alessandro had never come across one of those before, but serial killers were seriously sick bastards. And you could never really predict the things they might do for personal amusement. If one of those fucks were loose in New York, then it wasn't just the FBI who'd want his ass. Good thing the state of New York finally had a death penalty statute.
"Yes, I've seen him," Popoff told his boss.
"Really?" John Breitling asked. "How close?"
"About as close as we are, sir," the Russian replied. "It was not intentional, but it happened. He's a large, powerful man. His wife is a nurse at the local community hospital, and his daughter is a medical doctor, married to one of the other team members working at the same hospital." She is Dr. Patricia Chavez. Her husband is Domingo Chavez, also a CIA field officer, now assigned to this Rainbow Group, probably as a commando leader. Both Clark and Chavez are CIA field officers. Clark was involved in the rescue of the former KGB chairman's wife and daughter from Soviet territory some years ago. You'll recall the story made the press recently. Well, Clark was the officer who got them out. He was also involved in the conflict with Japan and the death of Mahmoud Haji Dariai in Iran. He and Chavez are highly experienced and very capable intelligence officers. It would be very dangerous to underestimate either of them, Popoff concluded.
Okay, what does that tell us?
It tells us that the Rainbow is what it appears to be, a multinational counter-terror group whose activities spread all across Europe. Spain is a NATO member, but Austria and Switzerland are not, you will recall. Could they expand their operations to other countries?
Certainly, yes.
They are a very serious threat to any terrorist operation. It is not, Popoff went on, an organization I would like to have in the field against me. Their expertise in actual combat operations we have seen on television. Behind that will be excellent technical and intelligence support as well. The one cannot exist without the other.
Okay. So we know about them. Is it possible that they know about us? Dr. Breitling asked.
Possible, but unlikely, Popoff thought. If that were the case, then you would have agents of your FBI in here to arrest you, and me, for criminal conspiracy. I am not being tracked or followed. Well, I do not think that I am. I know what to look for, and I have seen nothing of the sort. But I must also admit it is possible that a very careful and expert effort could probably follow me without my noticing it. That is difficult. I have been trained in counter-surveillance, but theoretically possible.
That shook his employer somewhat, Popoff saw. He just made an admission that he was not perfect. His former supervisors in KGB would have known it beforehand and accepted it as a normal risk of the intelligence trade. But those people never had to worry about being arrested and losing their billions of dollars of personal worth.
What are the risks?
If you mean what methods can be used against you?
He got a nod.
That means that your telephones could be tapped and...
My phones are encrypted. The system is supposed to be breakproof. My consultants on that tell me...
Popoff cut him off with a raised hand.
Sir, do you really think that your government allows the manufacture of encryption systems that it cannot itself break? He asked, as though explaining something to a child.
The National Security Agency at Fort Meade has some of the brightest mathematicians in the world, and the world's most powerful computers. And if you ever wonder how hard they work, you need only look at the parking lots.
Huh? What do you mean?
If the parking lots are filled at 7 in the evening, that means they are hard at work on something.
Everyone has a car in your country, and parking lots are generally too large to be enclosed and protected from even casual view. It's an easy way for an intelligence officer to see how active one of your government agencies is. And if you were really interested, you found out a few names and addresses, so as to know the car types and tag numbers. The KGB had tracked the head of NSA's Z Group, the people tasked both to crack and to create encryption systems and codes, that way for over a decade. And the reborn RVS was doubtless doing the same. Popov shook his head. No, I would not trust a commercially available encoding system. I have my doubts about the systems used by the Russian government. Your people are very clever at cracking cipher systems. They've been so for over 60 years, well before World War II, and they are allied with the British, who also have a tradition of excellence in that area of expertise. Has no one told you this? Popov asked in surprise. Well, no. I've been told that this system I have here could not be broken because it is a 128-bit. Ah, yes. The STU-3 standard. That system has been around in your government for about 20 years. Your people have changed to STU-4. Do you think they made that change merely because they wanted to spend money, Dr. Breitling? Or might there have been another reason? When I was in the field for KGB, I only used one-time pads. That is an encryption system only used one time, composed of random transpositions. It cannot be broken, but it is tedious to use. To send a single message that way could take hours. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to use for verbal communications. Your government has a system called Tap Dance, which is similar in concept, but we never managed to copy it. So you mean people could be listening in on every phone call I make? Popov nodded. Of course. Why do you suppose all of our substantive conversations have been made face-to-face? Now he was really shaken, Dmitri Arkadyevich saw. The genius was a babe in the woods. Now, perhaps, is the time for you to tell me why I have undertaken these missions for you.
Yes, Minister. Excellent. Thank you, Bob Auckland said into his cellular phone. He thumbed the end button and put the phone back in his pocket, then turned to Bill Henriksen.
Good news. We'll have that Rainbow Group down to consult on our security as well.
Oh? Bill observed. Well, I guess it can't hurt all that much.
Nose a little out of joint? The cop asked.
Well, not really, Henriksen lied. I probably know a few of them, and they know me.
And your fee will remain the same, Bill, the Aussie said. They headed off to his car, and from there they'd drive to a pub for a few pints before he drove the American off to the airport.
Oh, shit, the American thought. Once more, the law of unintended consequences had risen up to bite him in the ass. His mind went briefly into overdrive, but then persuaded itself that it didn't really matter all that much as long as he did his job right. It might even help, he told himself, almost believing it.
He couldn't tell Popov, Breitling knew. He trusted him in many ways. Hell, what Popov knew could put him in federal prison, even on death row. But to tell him what this was really all about? No, he couldn't risk that. He didn't know Popov's views on the environment and nature, so he couldn't predict the Russians' reaction to the project. Popov was dangerous to him in many ways, like a falcon trained to the fist, but still a free agent, willing to kill a quail or a rabbit, perhaps, but never entirely his, always able to fly off and reclaim his previous free life. And if he was free to do that, he was also free to give information to others. Not for the first time, Breitling thought about having Bill Henriksen take care of this potential problem. He'd know how. Surely the former FBI agent knew how to investigate a murder,
and thus how to befuddle the investigators as well. And this little problem would go away.
Assets, Breitling thought next. What other things could he do to make his position and his project more secure?